Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Magic Leap has a ship date, kind of. MacBook Pro owners get the CPU updates they deserve, AMD Ryzen 2500, 2600, and 2700 leaks, and how about that Motorola Moto G6? All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 474, recorded on July 12, 2018. It's transformative.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/Twitch and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most elegant, the most delightful, the most surreal, and the most peculiar hardware news available in the known or unknown universe. Today, a story from small town Florence, Kentucky, where, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Ryan Shroud is to be found contemplating the future of autonomous vehicles. I'm kidding, man. Hey, Ryan, I'm Patrick Norton.
I have no story for anybody. I was trying to brainstorm very quickly about a story I could tell you in about 12 seconds, but instead you got 12 seconds of me telling you that I had no such story for the lead-in. Yeah.
Were you surprised that Ford's going, you know, all four? Well, one, Ford's walking away from cars.
Right.
And they're working electric. That kind of blew my mind. Electric trucks.
It's a pretty drastic move to get rid of, say, I mean, in a fairly short time frame, we're going to stop selling cars with the exception of, you know, the Mustang and one other car, right? But keep our SUVs and keep our trucks. That's what's selling. That's a drastic swing.
Well, they're going to keep the Mustangs.
right. And I think there was one of the smaller cars as well. Maybe that was just in Europe they were going to keep or something like that. But
yeah. Well, in the U.S., the move to electric trucks, SUVs, and Mustangs. That's the U.S. So,
okay.
The move to electric, though, you're saying.
The move to electric is also pretty quick sounding based on their timeline. But, it, you know, stuff like the electric Ford F-150 or what have you, that's got to be a supplemental power system. They're not going to be able to get rid of the gas engines for that. Torque is great to get you moving, but if you want to continue moving, you know, if you're towing a trailer full of stuff or a camper or what have you, you know, it'd be nice to be able to continue to do that.
On one hand, I hear you, but as somebody who drives a diesel truck with 400 foot-pounds of torque and 160 horsepower, there is something to be said for appropriate gearing and having 6 or 8-speed transmissions. But I just thought it was crazy.
Because you don't have range issues.
I don't have range issues, but that's what's – I mean, I am curious to see what they can do because you can stuff a lot of batteries. You know, you take an 1,100-pound – you know, diesel engine out of the front of the truck, you can put in, you know, a 200-300-pound electric motor and several hundred pounds of batteries. I'm curious is to see what they can do in terms of, you know, next generation lithium ion batteries. If maybe they purchased a patent, they think that it's going to give them an advantage. I'm really curious because, yeah, I mean, I can pretty, if I do things right, maybe not with a trailer, I can get an 800-mile range out of my truck.
Right.
You know, in terms of, let me double check the math, but, you know, leaving a comfortable couple of gallons in the tank so I don't run out of gas, I should be good for like 450 miles towing a trailer on my truck and still have like 30 miles in reserve. But I just thought it was crazy to think of Ford, like A, like not doing cars except for the Mustang, and B, they're talking about 40 electrified vehicles, 16 of which will be EVs by 2022. So you're probably right. They're probably starting out with assistance. For me, what's always fascinating about electric vehicles, which is something you know intimately because you've been driving them every freaking day of your life for several years, you know, is the torque curve is just flat from zero RPM to maximum RPM, which for people who, you know, if people expect electric cars to be wimpy, but when you have several hundred foot pounds of torque, as soon as you touch the pedal, mayhem can happen really quickly if you're not prepared for it. You know, not so much with modern computer controlled, you know, or traction control equipped vehicles, but sorry, that just kind of blew my mind. I'm curious. I'll be curious to see what the hybrid F series trucks looks like. And, if they can do sort of it'd be interesting to see an all electric crossover, you know, like a small all wheel drive vehicle with 300 miles of range. We wait with bated breath. Or maybe not. Apple updated the 13 and 15 inch MacBook Pros, touch bars, the latest Intel CPUs, more RAM, True Tone displays, more storage, and oddly enough, notes The Verge, quieter keyboards. I was kind of curious about that. Yeah, and I like Mr. Dieter Bond's subhead on that article, slightly more than just spec bumps.
It was kind of interesting that they released it this way. There was just basically a press release announcement on their site. Right. I'm sure they sent it out to the media and whatnot, but no events, nothing like that. Updated some devices, but not others, like the MacBook with the touch display or the what's that? I just blanked on the strip.
The entry level 13 inch MacBook Pro, is not getting an update.
Right.
But
that's the only one that has physical function keys, worth noting.
Quote, which the community has taken to calling the MacBook Escape because it has a real escape key.
I like that. That's good.
To give you an idea of how far behind the processors were on the MacBook Pros, you know, Apple was saying that you're looking at a 70% bump in performance on the 15-inch model, and you should get a 100%, a doubling of speed on the 13-inch model. Think about that for a second. I'm laughing uncomfortably because, you know, these are not inexpensive machines.
Right.
And if you bought one last month, how pissed off are you going to be? You know, these are huge bumps in specs. And, you know, one of my running jokes, when I was doing a lot of $500 PC builds, I still love building $500 PCs, but my running joke is if you build a $500 PC and you can keep using it with sort of incremental upgrades to the GPU or adding some more memory you know, one of the big ones was when SSDs became affordable. You know, by the time you start with a $500 PC, which has sort of an entry level processor, you know, in 3 or 4 years when you go to, you know, build a new machine, you're getting what feels like an absolutely mind-blowing increase in performance. But, you know, these are like, you know, the entry level in these notebooks is $1,500, $1,800. And they were way behind on CPUs. So if you've been waiting out to buy a new MacBook Pro, you're a happy camper right now. 32 gigs of DDR4 memory on the 15-inch MacBook, which is pretty awesome. If you have the money, you can get like a 4-terabyte SSD inside of that. Up to 2 terabytes of storage inside of the 13-inch model. This is pretty cool, I think.
So the Core i9, so you get 6-core processors in that. I agree. That's pretty great. You also... Up to 4 terabytes of storage is fantastic to be able to get that in the mobile device, but it's not inexpensive.
No.
Because I think they're charging $1,000 per terabyte on that upgrade path, right? So they're charging you $1 a gig for NVMe storage, which is more than double what you should be paying, I would argue, for that. But Not an unexpected result based on who we're talking about, I guess. I do think I'm very curious to see what the differences are in the keyboard. If they are surely they're addressing the mechanical issues that they've had with the current generations of keyboards. They've noted that they're quieter. I'm a big fan of that across the board as well. The T2 chip, the new kind of processor that was available in the iMac Pro is now in the MacBook Pros that supports the Siri functionality on that too. So now that moves from just an iMac feature to a MacBook feature.
Right.
So if you happen to care about using that on your laptop, now you have that capability. I've never seen anybody do it yet, but I'm sure there are some of us out there.
Sure,
like talking to their computers.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, I mean, to put it in context, when you're looking at a NVMe, like a 2 terabyte NVMe drive, you're looking in the M.2 format, and I don't know what the format of the drive inside of the new MacBooks is. You're looking at 800 to 1,000, like a 960 Pro or a 970 Evo. You're looking at $800 to $1,000 for a 2 terabyte drive. So yeah. I don't know if I've even seen a 4 terabyte. I wonder if they have 2 NVMe slots or M.2 slots inside of there. Looking at like $800 for an NVMe drive. So either they're the only ones that have 4 terabyte NVMEs, or they are doing something really interesting that almost justifies, unspeakable expense of that.
I think Ken specced out the top level of this and it was like $6,700.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot there.
There's a lot there. So, you know, the other thing that I thought was interesting is they also announced, I work with Blackmagic and they're doing I like to call it a toaster, a Radeon Pro 580 external GPU with 8 gigs of video memory, and that's going to sell for $700. The Blackmagic E GPU, which also packs a couple of Thunderbolt ports, 4 USB 3 ports, an HDMI 2 port, supports Thunderbolt 3 displays, should you have the coin to pick up one of those 5K LG monitors. This is good if you are a video editor, and it's actually available now. And it does kind of look like a toaster in the sense of a Cylon. It's a classic. If you kind of click at the link, it's $700. It's only available from Apple, but it's got that sort of like air in through the bottom, out through the top. It's interesting. It's interesting.
It's one of those things where it's $700 for an RX 580, which is not a $500 graphics card. It's not a $400 graphics card. It's probably more like a $300 graphics card. So you're paying, for the Thunderbolt capability, the dock, the expansion. Like, you do get a lot of kind of add-ons for it, the USB, the Thunderbolt, the HDMI, the look, the style. Blackmagic stuff is an interesting. Blackmagic's a great brand. We use a lot of their stuff here. It's an in-between, I would call it. It's not like the highest-end, most expensive video gear you can get, but it's also not cheap knockoff stuff that you're getting on Amazon from a third-party reseller that you're not actually sure if you're going to be able to get support or to get it to function, right? So they're in this perfect niche for them of where there's not a lot of competition in that market. And they're doing a very good job there. This one, it's a little bit odd to me, too, that it's Apple only. I don't know if there are just enough support issues with trying to get external graphics cards working on Windows machines. When you might have RS3, you might have RS4, you have different Thunderbolt implementations on notebooks versus PCs. Whereas with the Mac, you just go, well, these 4 devices are supported. Boom, it's done. We've limited our incoming phone calls by a dramatic bit, right? So I'm sure that's a part of it.
If you're kind of curious about whether or not you want to spend $700 for an external GPU, I got to give props out to Puget Systems. They're a boutique, a small system integrator that they don't have the most inexpensive systems, because somebody pointed that out to me. They're like, well, you can get it cheaper. And I'm like, well, here's the thing. Puget Systems has incredible support. And one of the things they do up there is they spend a lot of time actually testing. I forwarded an article they did recently where they were looking at a whole bunch of GPUs and how they actually impact and how much they actually impact, and whether your money is better spent on a processor or a GPU upgrade, because there's a lot of mythology and there's a lot of rumors online about why you need this card or that card or this processor, or the GPU will do this or it'll do that. And the kind of radical slash frustrating thing is there are, you know, different things inside of different, different features inside of Premiere are effective radically differently with the GPU or the CPU. And there's no sort of, your GPU is going to accelerate everything. Well, kind of. A faster GPU is going to be faster, but the reality is it's not necessarily going to accelerate the thing you actually want. You know, and also, you know, they did a great, like, for example, looking at export performance, they benchmarked export performance between a GTX 1060, a 1070, a 1080, a 1080 Ti, a Titan XP, and a Titan V. Basically, if a 1080 was kind of the standard at 100%, a 1060, which is half the price, gave you 84.4% of the performance, and a Titan V gave you 117% of the performance. So, you know, you could spend twice as much on a GPU, but things are only getting about 17% faster. So the level of kind of benchmarking they're doing to kind of figure out what a recommended system is, I like what they're doing. I like to get people over to their websites to look at stuff. It's pretty fascinating, at least to me.
I agree.
Because there's not that many people doing kind of content creation or post-production testing. And props to Puget for putting the effort in on that one.
Agree.
New Surface Go. Portable power, which I think is kind of an oxymoron, a misleading title. Well, it's not an oxymoron. Well, maybe it is.
Or the name of a USB memory or a USB battery that you take with you to keep your phone charged.
Yeah. Well, and which is incredibly heavily searched if you look in Google Trends. I got an interesting tweet about this one. And quote, don't you guys agree that 4 gigabytes of RAM is not enough for today's tasks? The thing, when I was answering that tweet, I pointed out that almost every laptop manufacturer has like that model. And that model tends to be their $1,000 or $1,300 premium laptop. For example, I have very few qualms, one of which, probably the primary one, being the location of the webcam on Dell's XPS 13. The sort of nostril cam at the side. Their entry-level model often is a 4 gigabyte model, and HP does this, and just about everybody does this, where there's a 4 gigabyte model that's like really attractively priced. And you don't want that if you're running Windows, because Windows and 4 gigabytes sucks. And more often than not, you'll find that you can't actually upgrade that laptop because the memory is soldered on the motherboard. So to be honest with you, for me, the 4 gigabytes of RAM, which is problematic, but it's what everybody else does because they're building to a price point. $399 for 4 gigabytes of RAM and 64 gigabytes in an eMMC program, eMMC format, that kind of sucks. For me, the bigger issue is that you're not getting a keyboard unless you spend another $99.
Right.
So this is also only running Windows 10 in S mode, which means you can only use apps from the Microsoft Store, which means I'm pretty sure you can only use Microsoft Edge, which is really not something I'm interested in dealing with.
I mean, that's how it comes out of the box, but you can absolutely upgrade this out of S mode to Windows 10 Home full for free still.
Okay.
So you still have the capability to do that. And it's one of those, they're trying to very gently push people towards S mode because of its security and kind of cross platform compatibility that they're trying to ramp up. But that's not really what people wanted.
Right.
I still don't think they will want with that going forward.
I mean, if you want a tablet, buy an iPad.
Well, that's what I was going to say. This is going against the iPad. It's a $399 starting price, which is very, and I think the iPad starts at $379. This doesn't come with a keyboard, as you mentioned. It's price competitive with the iPads as you go up the stack But the difference is, obviously, here you're running Windows, you're running a different app ecosystem, you get a keyboard, you have different kind of productivity expectations at this point. And I actually see there are, you know, you could use the mindset of the portable professional or the person who's doing a tablet consumption. I think if you're doing consumption only, probably an iPad still makes the most sense. But if you're in education, and I'm kind of the mindset that iPads make the most sense for, let's say, up through elementary school, maybe beginning of middle school. But as soon as you get into things where you have to start typing, you have to start writing reports, you have to start generating content for your school, that a keyboard and Windows tends to make more sense, which is why Chromebooks, you know, are more like an operating system that we're used to than the iPad is. And I think that's really what Microsoft is kind of going after here. They're going to release an LTE model of this later in the year, apparently, as well. That's more interesting to me as a mobile professional that might be interested in this type of device. But then they made some hardware choices that don't really make sense. They're using the Intel Pentium Gold processor, which is essentially an Atom design. It's just what they've rebranded their successive Atom generations to. And it's fine. And I'm sure, I'm not positive of this, but my guess would be internally at Microsoft, they sat there and they went, is the Qualcomm Snapdragon 835 ready for this? Or do we want to go back to one of the lower cost, lower performance Intel solutions? And I think at the end, they decided to go with the Intel solution because of app compatibility. They didn't want to have questions about why some apps worked and some didn't with inside their own Surface line. But when you do that, you lose the huge bet. Like, this is only rated at 9 hours of battery life. Those Qualcomm ones are near 20. So there's a significant delta there. And then you, obviously, anything that would have a Qualcomm chip would have LTE connectivity or potential LTE connectivity. And this, at its lowest prices, is not. So they clearly made some trade-offs from a hardware point of view in order to make sure they had the fewest question marks going forward, even though I think it was sacrificed a little bit on the capabilities of the unit.
It's interesting when you look at some of the stats for educational sales in the United States, mobile, I don't have numbers for desktops, but when you look at mobile hardware in the United States, like 57-59% running through the end of Q4 is Chrome OS. iOS is like maybe 10-15%. Mac OS is single digits, like sub 5%. And Windows is in the sort of, you know, it vacillates from like 18-25%. Windows is actually more popular in the rest of the world than it is in the U.S. in educational systems for mobile devices, possibly because Chromebooks just haven't penetrated as much. But, you know, you're just starting to get a lot of the first of the sort of $300, $400-ish Windows devices or that they're starting to come out in volume. I think I'm torn because there's a lot of things I like about the Surface Books and the Surface Pro, or to say the Surface Pro especially, where it's this really nice, you know, as odd as the kind of 3x2-ish screens were, like, that didn't really bother me so much long term. By the Surface 3, that magnetic keyboard is actually pretty functional and highly useful. You know, but if you spend more money, you don't necessarily get a lot of performance because they've stuck to their guns with having a passive cooling system, which actually destroyed, you know, a friend of mine had a, you know, what amounted to a $3,000 you know, Surface device that he couldn't actually do anything on because the thermals throttled the performance of the processor to the point that it was considerably slower than a sub $1,500 laptop. And, most people are going to buy that $549 version of this. I think for education, you know, I think Google's working incredibly hard to take what they've built and built on it. And a lot of that has to do with the administrative and backend tools and being able to lock down the environment. I'm really curious to see what's going on, you know, in terms of, like, you know, is 4 gigabyte of RAM not enough? Not particularly if you tend to run multiple applications simultaneously. I'm very curious to see what that EMMC memory or storage performance is like, because it's certainly going to be slower than an SSD. I think most people are going to go to the $549 system, or they're going to be frustrated by that $399 system. You know, for me though, $500 with a keyboard is a lot of money for that, and I'd be pointing people towards a Chromebook at that point. I don't know. You know, the other thing is, you know, the 1800 by 1200 pixel sense monitor at a whopping 217 pixels per inch probably won't be awful, but compared to some of the other offerings out there, I think is going to be. I think you will enjoy. I may be spoiled because I've been working on an ultrawide monitor on my desktop, so you know, it is in the neighborhood of 1920 by 1080, but I'd like a little more horizontal space on that one. So interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
I agree.
I'll be curious what sales are like on that. I'll also be curious whether or not Microsoft bumps the performance on the more high-end Surface devices. Because, you know, anybody who's doing any kind of power work, whether they're a programmer compiling or just running a ton of apps simultaneously, has to be incredibly frustrated by the high-end Surface devices. Yeah. In any case, I'm starting to mumble, so... 2600E and 2700E, those are the lower power Ryzen models. They just started showing up online. The Ryzen 5 2600E is looking like a really nice processor. You're talking about 6 cores, 12 threads, and half gigahertz base frequency. Base frequency is a half gigahertz lower than the 2600X at 3.1 gigahertz, writes Jeremy Hellstrom. And the Ryzen 7 2700E, 8 cores, 16 threads, 1.1 gigahertz down to a base of 2.8 gigahertz. Quote, sadly, the rumors did not reveal details about the boost clock. So for now, that remains pure speculation. Do we assume that these details have been leaked by AMD to prepare people for the launch of the part, or is this just
probably not,
or at least just to keep people from buying? Probably not.
Probably not.
Okay.
It's still. I mean, these are the low TDP parts. You're going to lose some frequency on it, but you know, if your goal is quiet, efficient computing rather than just the most performance you can get in that form factor, these are going to be great. These are essentially better binned versions of the same silicon. There's nothing new or particularly different about what we're looking at here. I don't know exactly when we'll see them. But if this much information is coming out, it's going to be relatively quick, relatively soon. But we are still kind of waiting for some of those to filter their way out still.
Yeah, it was the other interesting rumor that came out also up at the Inquirer. They're writing about Hong Kong site X Fastest, who got a hold on what they're saying is the Ryzen 5 2500X 4-core, 8-thread, 3.6 gigahertz base clock with a 4 gigahertz boost clock. I'm going to quote Lee Bell over at the Inquirer, who writes... X Fastest only shared one bit of benchmark data about the Ryzen 5 2500X, and that was that the chip overclocked to 4.3 gigahertz through XFR in Ryzen Master, where it was able to garner a pretty impressive 1,066 point score in Cinebench R15. So they're running an X470 motherboard, 16 gigs of RAM, and the memory was clocked at 3,600 megahertz. So I don't know. I'm just still excited about the Ryzen processors.
Yeah, so we're it's interesting because I'm trying to think what the schedule was last year when we saw the 1800X, 1700X, and then we saw the 1600s and the 1500s. We saw 28s, 27s, and maybe 16s at the same time, and then we saw kind of the mid-range come out relatively soon afterwards. It's been a little bit longer delay this time, and I don't know if that's they're waiting for some inventory to clear in the channel of the older generation of this same price segment or not. We are still missing some of that. We haven't seen the Ryzen Pro versions of the the workstation class versions of the Zen Plus architecture either. So we are still kind of waiting a little bit on that. And then obviously Threadripper 2000 series, when we get to see our 32 core parts here by the end of the summer, I'm pretty sure.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We should take a moment to thank our sponsor. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Ring's mission to make neighborhoods safer. And the Ring Video Doorbell lets you see and speak to intruders on your smartphone from anywhere, even share video clips with neighbors using the Ring app. What's your favorite? At this point, you have a Ring at home, a Ring Video Doorbell at home. You have a Ring Video Doorbell at the PC Per World International Headquarters. What's your favorite incident involving the Ring Video Doorbell at this point, Mr. Shrout?
I'm fortunate enough to say I don't have what I would call incidents. nobody trying to break into a house or an office that way. I think I've told the story before of catching the probably not 21-year-olds drinking giant malt liquor cans in the parking lot of our office, for example, and scaring the bejesus out of them by talking to them from the Ring that way. So that was fun, except that I had to come in the next morning and clean up the cans that they left behind because they left in a hurry, as you might have imagined. But it's good. It's good peace of mind to have either way.
Oh, my goodness. But you know what? You didn't have to go out there and confront them directly, which I think is a big plus.
Yes.
Interesting story. Check this video out. I'm gonna read the tweet straight here. A serial burglar was taken off the streets after she was spotted casing Clifford's home on Ring. Upon reporting the video to law enforcement, she was immediately identified as an individual with several prior alleged thefts and burglaries. That's up on twitter.com/ring. They're working, people. You may have to clean up the beer cans. You may have to call the cops, but it's nice to know what's going on. Ring's floodlight, by the way, bringing light to the situation. The floodlight and spotlight cam lets you build a ring of security around your entire property. Look at that, people. Just like Ring's video doorbell, floodlight cam, motion-activated camera, and a floodlight that connects to your phone. With high visibility floodlights, HD video, and two-way audio, it lets you know the moment anyone steps onto your property. And as Ryan has attested, it's useful. You can see and speak to visitors. I think it's gracious visitors. Even set off an alarm right from your phone. When things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. Is it teenagers with beer cans? Is it the neighbor's dog? You're going to know. Ring floodlight cams offer the ultimate in home security. Thieves just can't hide with Ring. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of Security kit, which includes a Ring video doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. And you can connect your Ring video doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. Stop crime before it happens and make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Save up to $150 on a Ring of Security kit at ring.com/twitch. That's ring.com/twitch. Up to $150 off when you go to ring.com/TWICH. We want to thank Ring for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. It's exciting. It's exciting when people don't steal your stuff. Well, somebody stole something off my porch recently. Apparently, it's time for me to get a Ring video. Oh. What's going on? Jeremy's title on this, Captain Undervolt and the RX Vegas 64S. What's going on with undervoltaging GPUs?
So, I mean, this has kind of been some... It is. Well, probably. What do I know? This is a thing that has been popular for a while. People do it with processors, main CPUs, and for GPUs. Although GPUs maybe have a more dramatic effect because the idea of undervolting is that you do exactly what that is. You run the GPU at a lower voltage and either attempt to maintain the same clocks at the lower voltage, mm-hmm. or you're willing to lower clock speeds along with it. And the idea is if the GPU you have is running hotter or louder than you want, or it's just drawing more power than you would like, you could, this kind of started with the first Fiji parts, where you could undervolt them and oftentimes get the same level of performance at 20% less power draw. Now, it seems crazy that you would be able to do that, and AMD wouldn't have been taking advantage of that to begin with. The problem is they're building their voltage curves and kind of their systems around worst case scenarios and kind of where the range of binning is. So a lot of times they have to say, okay, we could probably get away with 1.1 volts on 80% of the GPUs, but we need 1.2 volts to hit all 100% of the GPUs that we're going to sell. So we're going to put them all at 1.2, so we don't have to worry about it. that's the best answer if you're AMD. But if you're a consumer and you like to tweak things, you know, a lot of people like to tweak up and go to overclocking, more voltage, more power, more noise, whatever. They don't really care. Or you go the other way down to lower voltage, power, and power draw because of it.
I was going to say, is this the future? But the reality is I think most of us are perfectly happy to make things louder.
Yes.
You know, outside of like home theater and gaming
PCs. It's true.
It is
so
true.
You know, but if you, the testing that Overclockers Club did is that, you know, they did three games. They said they saw a noticeable drop in power use when undervolting and not limiting the frame rate or using a high frame rate limit. This reduction in power use is important as it improves the efficiency of the Vega 64 and allows increased clock speeds with the reduction of thermal throttling. And that's kind of an interesting tweak there too, is they were able to see higher clock speeds on average with undervolting because the GPU wasn't running as hot and therefore it wasn't throttling as it would be. Now that that seems more like a poor design decision or implementation decision by an OEM, a partner, or somebody that maybe just said, I don't know, these were the specs that they came out from the manufacturer for me, dial it into the BIOS and let's move on, as opposed to really spending time and tweaking. But to be fair, every piece of silicon is going to behave a little bit differently and some drastically differently than others. And I think, you know, the Vega parts they're great GPUs, but they have some of the same kind of efficiency disadvantages compared to the GeForce parts that Fiji had as well. And so it kind of makes sense that this would all fall in line.
It also makes me wonder, like, if you could get a more, yes, Homer, I feel you. If you could get a more efficient cooler on there, would that afford you the opportunity to clock up higher because you could increase the voltage more at that point? But, yeah. You know.
I mean, that's true. There's a ton of knobs to turn, knobs being voltage or cooling capability or clock speed or what have you. And then they all affect each other. They're just like gears in a clock type of thing. So you've got to be careful one way or the other. But yes, a better cooler, like if you went to the extreme of LN2, now you've taken thermal throttling completely out of the picture, right? It's not practical, but it is like the extreme case of it. So yeah, a better cooler, as long as you're willing to deal with either the higher cost of the new cooler or the additional noise of the new cooler, will change that algorithm quite a bit.
Oh my goodness. If you've been contemplating buying a new phone and the price of the flagships frighten you, and they probably should, if you're not looking at something like a OnePlus 6, which is a fantastic phone for the money. Shannon took a look this week on TechThing at the Motorola's Moto G6. And the downside of this phone is, in the U.S., it's only available in the 3 gigabyte, 32 gigabyte model. If you're in the U.K., you can pick up the 6 gigabyte, 64 gigabyte model. And I only say that because I want more space to store my songs, number one. And number two, I want to be able to do 7 or 8 months of photos without removing them from the phone. But it'll do a 128 gigabyte micro SD card. I was shocked at how good this was. It's a $249.99 phone, 5.7-inch IPS LCD. It's a 1080p display, which is not as fabulous as some of the high-end displays, but this is a $250 phone. They are following a lot of the high-end phones, but doing an 18x9, the sort of longer, skinnier phone layout on that one. So it's not quite as... it's not quite as retinal as the more high-end phones, but it's really, really nice and really, really thoughtful. For example, you can adjust the dimness down pretty much to nothing, which is something I really, really wish iOS would allow me to do on my iPhone. You know, it's Gorilla Glass on the front and back. The Gorilla Glass back scares me. Bluetooth 4.2, wireless, aptX, all are awesome things. USB-C, which I think is a really smart choice, and it is inclusive. It includes a headphone jack, which makes me really, really happy. 3,000 milliamp hour battery, takes like an hour and 40 minutes to fully charge. I will let you head over to techthing.com if you want to see what the audio quality looks like. But I will tell you this, if you like to walk around taking photos, this one is the $250 phone. This one, I should say videos, this one is what the $1,000 phone looks like. but not a bad looking camera. I was laughing because Shannon was like, eh, on the camera. And I was like, actually, that looks amazing. But she basically buys a new flagship phone every 6 to 8 months. And I'm running an iPhone 6 that I've been running forever. You know, comes with the Moto software, which is not pure Android, but it's essentially Android 8.0 Oreo with a little bit of extra thrown on top, but not enough that it's going to drive you completely insane. You know, for me, I would immediately need to throw a micro SD card into it, or I would use up all the space with music. Snapdragon 450, 1.8 gigahertz octa-core processor, and again, 3 gigs of RAM and 32 gigabytes of storage. I hate that they don't have more storage available, but I think they really want you to step up and spend more money on a phone if you want more storage, at least in the United States, or just, you know, buy a freaking micro SD card. You know, it's amazing. This was $1,000. This was an back when before flagships were $1,000. So this was an $800 flagship phone 2 or 3 years ago. It is now outclassed by the $1,000 phones, but it costs a quarter of the price. Yeah, I was pretty impressed. That actually may be my next phone because the compass has died in my iPhone 6, and the fact that I can't use the compass to move my. applications around my astronomy applications around has been driving me more and more nuts over the last few weeks. Magic Leap, a company we've been covering for what seems like forever, most of which almost entirely on the extraordinary hype their incredible valuation had generated. I still don't understand how they can possibly sell enough of their gadgets to pay back the incredible amount of venture capital they've taken in. But we have a release date, kind of. AT&T and Magic Leap form exclusive U.S. consumer relationship to expand the future of spatial computing. This is like the breathiest PR announcement I've read in forever. A strategic exclusive U.S. consumer relationship and investment with Magic Leap, developer of proprietary spatial computing and experiential platforms. Magic Leap is not augmented. It is transformational technology. You know, it's one of the breathiest press announcements I've ever read, which given how long I've been reading these is kind of terrifying to say out loud. But essentially, Magic Leap will be shipping this summer their Creator's Edition. And I'm really curious to see this, if for no reason than I desperately, just for fun, want to see this live up to or exceed the incredibly breathy hype that's around it. I would like to point out that summer actually started a few weeks ago, and they have until September, and I really, really hope they ship. NVIDIA Tegra X2 processor, it's going to be an AT&T only. As far as I can tell, there is no price, which may mean it is priceless.
Let me give you my take on this. It's been 4 years. We've been treated to video after video of amazing footage, whether or not it was real or not. Correct.
Because this is no longer...
Whether or not it was real or manufactured, unknown, probably clearly based on the demo we saw that is real. Here's the thing. Technologically, it's not nearly as superior as it first seemed, which makes sense because it first seemed that way 4 years ago. And now we've moved on. We've got, you know, ARKit on Apple. We've got Qualcomm's entry into AR and VR. We've got like even the damn Lenovo Star Wars Jedi Challenges thing, right? All of these have set the stage very differently for Magic Leap. Now, the demo that they showed, the one that was called Dodge, that is you point at a surface and deem that a surface from which a golem comes out of the ground,
right.
And it's cool. It takes the texture of the ground and it rips it up, and then this golem comes up and he throws big rocks at you. And as the name would imply for Dodge, which is the game, you can either swat the rocks away, which is cool because your hand is interacting with something that's not really there, or you can dodge out of the way and let it go behind you. And when you do that, the rock will hit the real life surface behind you and shatter in the virtual world, right? So it's kind of interesting that that happens. You see, that's a bad example because it hit the guy in the face. They did not play the game Dodge very well. So there's the hand doing it. I think the next one, maybe they throw it over you. But what you'll notice is like the graphics here are way less impressive than, you know, the previous videos would show right. you. It's a little bit juddery. Like the tracking isn't perfect. This is probably more realistic to what you're actually going to see. Is it neat? Yes. Is it transformative? No. And no matter all the words they want to use about light fields and all this other kind of stuff, this is a known quantity now. And if nothing mm-hmm. else, they're the leader in a well understood space. They're no longer a leader in a mysterious place where they can
right.
make stuff up and expect everybody to drag along. But on the bright side, they've put out a shipping date. They haven't announced or a shipping time frame. They haven't put out pricing. So for me, this goes from a vaporware discussion to a will it live up to the hype discussion, which is a movement in the right direction for them, right? They needed to prove that they could do something. Yeah. They have a lot of investors in this that have put a lot of money into the magic that they claim that they'll be creating. So we'll see.
I was going to say, part of me wonders, part of me wonders just exactly how good this is, because AT&T paid, I think they were like, they took a stake in Magic Leap to get the exclusive distribution deal. Obviously AT&T has a lot of money to spend, right? Because they're dropping $85 billion on Time Warner. They bought like AppNexus for $2 billion. But this is it's crazy. There's they've taken in well in excess of $1 billion at Magic Leap. So certainly a lot of people are buying into the hype here. They've raised in excess of $2 billion at this point, including money from Google, Alibaba. It must be really transformative when you see the real demo, because people keep cutting gigantic checks. And this is another gigantic check.
That's true.
And you know what I mean? Like this is yet another gigantic check from, AT&T is on kind of a spending spree right now, or maybe, once you've dropped $85 billion, another half a billion or billion here and there doesn't feel like much, but there's a lot of money being pumped into this. Like this is, $2.35 billion before whatever AT&T dropped into it. And AT&T's not even talking about like, hey, we're going to have a super cool device for the holiday shopping season. They're just talking about having something targeted towards developers, which hopefully is targeted towards developers at the sort of Oculus end of the scale and not at the Microsoft end of the scale. We've been waiting. We will wait. Hopefully by September, they actually
September
have
22nd.
Something. That is the end of the summer. That is the last possible
the end of the
day
summer.
For a summer release. Man, and I thought I was a cynic. Goodness. I just hope they actually release it this summer. And I hope it's not at a price that makes people, immediately go like, are you insane?
If you thought you looked odd with a VR headset on, like that, I think these look even more weird. And what's worse is you can see people looking at you weirdly as well. Yeah. Whereas before you put on a VR headset, you can just assume that they're not there. You just, close your eyes, doesn't matter type of deal. You don't have that capability with the Magic Leap. So,
we'll see. We'll see how it goes. Because it's never too early for rumors, we'll just end on while we're speculating on the eventual existence of a Magic Leap product. There are TF International Securities, Ming-Chi Kuo has his latest round, he or her, latest round of speculation on new Apple products. 11-inch iPad Pro, a Mac Mini update, 1.57 and 1.78-inch Apple Watches, and Air Power coming in the fall. So his predictions, my apology. Yeah, bigger bezel sizes on the Apple Watch may be the most interesting one on that list. I'll be very, very curious to see what Apple comes up with and what the next generation iPhone looks like. So, I'm also hoping that the next generation AirPods that are being speculated on in this actually sound better. So,
yeah, I would be okay with that. Yep. Can I get the wireless charger now?
Come on. Apple going wireless charging just as wireless charging loses momentum.
Sounds about right.
On that bright and cheerful and slightly obnoxious note, PC Per, anything, I feel like there are going to be no more GPU and no more CPU announcements. Okay, we're going to have the entry-level AMDs or the less expensive AMD Ryzen stuff, right? One would hope, given the giant flood of 2500X, 2600, 2700 news we talked about this week, Intel seems to be spinning its wheels in terms of processor introductions, or maybe you've had a briefing that I haven't. NVIDIA, I don't think there's any reason for them to drop a new GPU right now. AMD's kind of finally filling their pipeline. You know, should we just stop talking about hardware news for the rest of the summer and just wait for the Magic Leap to show up?
No, I mean, like, look, we know Threadripper 2 is coming. Threadripper 2000 series is coming this summer. We know it seems damn likely at this point that NVIDIA is going to have GPUs out sometime at the end of the summer. AMD won't have anything. They have never shown anything on the roadmap that makes us believe that. So there's still a lot of stuff coming. I would say for people who want to read about tech that in hardware that we're interested in, we posted that G-Sync HDR monitor review, the Asus PG27Q. I can't remember what the name model number it was, but you'll know what it is. There you go, PG27UQ. Still the thing that you know, when we come into the office every day is impressing us a little bit each time. There is a bug we found where if you run it at a non-4K resolution, if you run it at 1080p, you can't go full screen in it. It tiles in the middle of the screen. That's apparently a driver issue that they're going to fix. So if you had if you didn't have a Titan XP or a 1080 Ti and you didn't want to play at 4K, you wanted to play at 1080p with HDR enabled, you couldn't without playing on a very tiny window. So they'll get that fixed, and then we'll see how if HDR is affected in any way that way. We also took, I don't know if Ken posted on the website or not, but we posted another teardown picture of the back of that display that shows the detail of the 384 zone backlight. I think he just posted it on Twitter, so yeah, you won't be able to find it right now. It's an impressive array of hardware to get that running. Because basically each LED zone has to have its own power delivery system. So there's 384 of that inside the monitor. When you start to dissect more of it, you start to go, oh, there it is. You start to go, oh, yeah, no, this is an expensive monitor, isn't it? So all those little MOSFETs you see, that's only one half. That's only 196. No, hold on. 384 divided by two. It's only half of the array there. So it's neat. It's neat stuff. I don't recommend anybody else take apart a $2,000 monitor, but
no.
Now you can see pictures of it at least.
Yeah. Well, one of the questions we used to get a lot on HD Nation, and we don't get so much anymore, either because reliability on monitors has increased or B, people have gotten the messages. We had a lot of questions back in the day, like, how can I replace the broken screen on my HD TV? And the answer is almost invariably, you can't. Not so much because it's that difficult, although it is there are worse things. It isn't a wicked ripping pain in the ass, for example, to unglue a glued on screen on a laptop. But it is almost impossible to get, you basically have to buy another television to strip out the parts you need to fix the television you have. It is a nightmare. And as you look at the inside of that monitor, you start to realize, like, imagine having to deal with all those connectors. And if you get just one of them backwards, you have to pull the entire thing apart again and root your way through them. So I don't know. Seems like an absolutely fantastic monitor, but for $2,000, delete expletive better be a fantastic monitor. So as money rained from the sky. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us for this week in Computer Hardware. We do Twitch weekly. Each and every week, Ryan Trout and I, we try to bring you, hardware news. Mobile, portable, console, laptop, and apparently even the occasional wearable device. I forgot to tell you about the Tap wearable keyboard. which enables one-handed typing. I will do that next week. Right. And we will be here next week. So do us a favor, check it out. You can find, well, you're looking at right now, if you got the video, twitch.tv/TWICH. You can find more of Ryan Trout at Ryan Trout on Twitter at PC Purr. You can find more of me at Patrick Norton. That's the best way to contact us, by the way, by our Twitter handles, if you will. And we thank you for listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.